The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, the award-winning website creation platform that helps you make the front page. With Getty Image integration and elegant templates, you can give your viewers the whole picture. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Hannah Devlin. This week it was revealed that astronomers are about to start the most intensive ever search for alien life. The Breakthrough Listen project will scan stars in 100 galaxies for radio and optical signatures that indicate that someone or something is out there. Until now, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI as it's also known, has been met with an eerie silence. What makes scientists so convinced that it's worthwhile looking for alien life? What are the chances that we'll find something? And should we consider beaming our own messages out into the cosmos? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The Breakthrough Listen project marks a renewed scientific effort to search for intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. It's come about thanks to a $100 million donation by Yuri Milner, a Russian internet billionaire and philanthropist. Over the next 10 years, the money will be used to buy time on some of the world's most powerful telescopes to hunt for radio and optical signals coming from the nearest million stars in our own galaxy, along with stars in 100 neighbouring galaxies. I'm joined in the studio by three of the astronomers involved in the Breakthrough Initiative. Frank Drake, the American astronomer who's widely seen as the father of the modern SETI effort, Jeff Marcy and Andrew Simeon, both astronomers at the University of California, Berkeley. We're also joined by Dr. Nick Lane, an evolutionary biochemist at University College London, whose work looks at how life started on Earth. Welcome to you all. Frank, for the uninitiated, could you just tell us a bit about how you go about searching for signals from aliens? What kind of things do you have to look for?
Well, you take a very sensitive radio telescope and you point it in the direction of a place where you might expect a signal to come from, particularly a star which is perhaps like the sun and therefore might have a planetary system like our own. And then you use a radio receiver which is very sensitive, and it's been made very sensitive by receiving only a narrow amount, a small amount of signals from a very narrow range of frequencies in the radio spectrum. And you just see if there's anything there. Sometimes there's things there that are really from our civilization which leak into the radio telescopes. So we have to, when we see something like that, we have to do some kind of test to see where the signal is actually coming from. And the important test is it coming from a place fixed with respect to the stars? That is, then not a place on Earth, but a place very far away in the universe, just as the stars are. If we find the source of the signal is actually moving, that is, we have to move our radio telescope to continue to receive the signal, that tells it's really from Earth and it's not of interest to us. However, if it's really tracking the stars, then that makes it a promising candidate. And we have some other tests we then do to see if it's truly coming from very great distances.
Do we have to assume that it's a particular type of signal? I mean, are we looking for a beacon from aliens, or might it just be some sort of, you know, electrical noise that's coming off communication systems on another planet?
Well, it can be just about anything, and we can work with it. Likely signals include radar transmissions from radar transmitters. These are generally a series of pulses. They can be streams of data, which are a stream of characters which sound like sometimes music or noise. And there could be signals which are intentionally sent to get our attention. And these would be signals which are very loud and pretty continuous in their nature. That would be a clue that these were signals to get our attention. But the real answer to your question is we're sensitive to everything, and that's, of course, the way it should be because we can't predict what the extraterrestrials will be doing.
The SETI effort's obviously been going on for several decades now, and it's been fruitless. We haven't found anything. I'm interested in what this extra $100 million is going to buy us and how it's going to advance the search.
Well, it is going to enhance the search very greatly. Yes, we have searched for 55 years now, mostly with borrowed instruments where we are guest observers on somebody else's radio telescope. This means normally we don't get much observing time. We haven't had enough money to buy observing time, so we've been the poor people sort of begging for occasional periods of time on radio telescopes to make a search. Worked hard to make radio receivers that can monitor many channels at once so that we're covering many possible places that signals might be located in the radio spectrum. And that speeds up the search, but still, over the years, the situation has been very limiting. We have not come close to comprehensively studying the star and searching the sky for signals. And indeed, over all those years, we have not looked at the whole sky nearly. We've not even looked at the places where the stars are thickest, that is, in the Milky Way galaxy. And most of all, we've not looked at all the plausible radio frequencies where there might be signals. We've looked at only a few percent of the range of frequencies which we think are promising places for signals to be sent. Now, all of this is a result of having little access to radio telescopes. Now, what's happened recently is that support for some of the biggest radio telescopes, financial support, has declined to where these instruments are in financial straits and financial difficulties. They are willing and eager to sell time on the telescopes to people to use them for whatever means. And what we have done is make arrangements so far with two such telescopes, among the largest ones in the world, the Green Bank Telescope, which is a 100-meter telescope in the state of West Virginia in the United States, and the Parkes Telescope, Parkes spelled with an ES at the end, which is the largest radio telescope in the Southern Hemisphere. Southern Hemisphere is important to us, by the way, because that's where the center of the galaxy is, where most of the stars are, and so that needs to be observed. With these telescopes, and now the time we have on them, we can do much more searching, but even more than that, we now have advanced digital circuitry and components available to us with which we can build equipment which can monitor enormous numbers of channels at once. We're looking to monitor up to 10,000 million channels at the same time. This will speed the search up by an enormous margin over what we've done in the past. So what the support to the tune of $100 million from Yuri Milner means is that we can now, instead of begging for telescope time, we can now have it, and we can have a lot of it, and we can observe a lot of frequencies, and this will mean that we can do way more searches in just a few days than all previous searches combined. And, of course, we move on from that to doing what's really needed, which is to observe in all directions in the sky and over the full range of frequencies where we expect signals might be. And this is an enormous advance. To those of us who have been in this business, it's just a miracle.
I'm interested that the project's called the Breakthrough Listen Project, but why are we just listening? Shouldn't we be broadcasting messages as well? I'd be interested in what you think about that, Frank, and also Jeff and Andrew.
Various opinions about whether we should be sending messages. There are some people who feel that we're obligated to send messages just because it's fair. If we expect them to send messages to us, we should be sending messages to them. Now, those of us who do the searching take a different view, at least I do, and that is that at the present time it is a waste of resources to send messages. And the reason is that the nearest civilizations must be many tens or probably hundreds of light years away. so that any message we might send won't be received for 10 or hundreds of years. And then if they choose to reply, it will take another tens or hundreds of years for this response to get here. In other words, when we send messages now, we will get no benefit from those messages for perhaps centuries. And to us, it is much more important to find those other civilizations soon than to send a message and wait hundreds of years for an answer.
That's interesting, because a lot of people would assume that part of the point of finding the signals would be so that you'd then set up some kind of communication pathway. But it sounds like even if you found a signal, there's no guarantee that you would ever sort of have any meaningful back and forth with the other civilization.
Yes, two-way conversations are going to be very slow. And that's just the way it is. There's a great distances which separate the stars. But indeed, if we ever found a civilization, then we would study it and I think undoubtedly put together a message which we would think would be useful to that other civilization and send it, even though, of course, we wouldn't get a benefit from that for perhaps hundreds of years. In response to your question, yes, at the present time, we think it's a waste of resources and just slows the search down to be sending messages. But if ever we receive one, then the situation will change and we will send.
This is Jeff. I really do agree with what Frank said, but I would add another avenue here of discussion. Who would send the message, and how would they construct that message, and who would that message represent? Would it represent the company that generated the message, the small group of people, the country, the religion, the culture? The actual process by which we humans would carry out a discussion, perhaps globally, about how to best represent humanity is a discussion worth having. And indeed, the discussion might be more valuable than the actual construction and sending of the message.
Do you have any thoughts on what would be an appropriate message or inappropriate message to send to potential aliens?
Well, my own opinion would be that, again, the discussion is more important, but what I suspect will come about from such a discussion is a representation of humanity showing our diversity of music, art, philosophy, perhaps emotions, and our science. And such a message would have to be very delicately crafted to make sure that most, if not all, of the humans on the globe right now felt that the message represented them.
And presumably one that didn't appear to be aggressive towards another civilization. I mean, are these things that people consider as well?
Well, it's an interesting aspect here, which is we all are a little worried about our anthropological baggage that has led us to be somewhat competitive with a Darwinian origin. And we might want to be somewhat honest with the extraterrestrials to explain to them that we're concerned about our own history, that we are indeed struggling to find ways to achieve harmony on the planet Earth among the countries and the cultures. And we might even reach out to those extraterrestrials, asking them for some advice. If they're 1,000 years advanced compared to us, how did they solve the problem of achieving harmony on their world?
So you're saying it shouldn't necessarily be a sort of happy man and woman hugging each other. We should maybe show them our dark side as well.
Well, you've just made a horrible faux pas, given that we're working very hard to achieve equal rights for gays and lesbians. And therein exactly is why this is a beautiful effort, because the very discussion, as we're having right now, will leave us with a broader sense of, in fact, who we are and how we might want to represent ourselves cosmically.
And, of course, getting all this across without the use of language, presumably.
Well, another entire dimension is, how do you send a message that could be decrypted? We would presumably send ones and zeros, maybe some kind of analog signal, but how in the world would they ever be able to figure out what language we were using? And of course, there is an answer to this. It would be to send pictures. If we sent two-dimensional or maybe even three-dimensional pictures, they might notice that the bits, the ones and the zeros, could be assembled into a two-dimensional or three-dimensional image. And then, of course, we might be able to associate words, if you will, with those pictures and build up language.
I wanted to come on now to the Drake equation, obviously named after you, Frank. This is, for those who aren't familiar with it, is an attempt to put some kind of estimate on the number of civilizations with which radio communication might be possible. It's based on a variety of factors, things like the fraction of stars with planets. Since Frank came up with the equation in the 1960s, we've got a lot more information about the different parameters that go into the equation. And one of those is the number of stars with planets. Jeff, you've spent a lot of your career searching for exoplanets. I'd be interested in what you think about how the discovery of nearly 2,000 planets outside our solar system has changed the SETI effort and the way the search is perceived.
Well, we're enjoying an actual explosion, if you will, of knowledge and insight about how common planets that are habitable are in our universe. The NASA Kepler Spaceborne Telescope showed us that something like one out of every five stars that you see in the night sky harbors a planet nearly the size of the Earth at lukewarm temperatures. And of course, such a planet, if it had water, would have water in liquid form, and liquid water is the cocktail mixer of the biochemistry of life.
So generally, it's been a huge boost for hopes that there might be the conditions out there for life.
I think for every school child, once you learn that habitable planets are common, the next question is, well, are they inhabited? And if so, by what types of critters? Are there just single-celled bacteria of some sort? Are there multicellular critters? And could there, in fact, be intelligent life on any of those planets?
Well, this is exactly what Nick's been working on. Your work is focused on how life emerged on Earth and how it developed after that. I'd be really intrigued to know what you think of that question, and maybe also the focus on water being a crucial element for life. Is that really all it needs, or are there other things that are involved as well?
Well, we don't know. Nobody can agree about how life started on Earth, under what set of conditions it happened, and whether we can generalise or extrapolate from that in any way. But what we can try to do is try to get a grip on the conceptual underpinnings, if you like, what it takes to turn a sterile planet into a living planet. As I say, views differ on that, but one of the most promising avenues, at least in my view, is the possibility of a particular kind of hydrothermal vent, alkaline hydrothermal vents. Well, they require, to produce about the best set of conditions imaginable for life to start, they require rocks, minerals like olivine, which are ubiquitous really throughout the universe, in interstellar dust as well as in planets, and water. And you have a reaction, a chemical reaction between the rock and the water, which produces these hydrothermal vents, which are rich in hydrogen gas and naturally compartmentalized. And basically, you have a focusing of carbon and energy flux in these places. Now, that means a wet, rocky planet with CO2 in the atmosphere as a carbon source. The number of planets, Earth-like planets, wet, rocky planets out there could be as many as 40 billion in the Milky Way alone. So, yes, from that point of view, it seems highly likely that at least life at the level of bacteria ought to be quite common. Again, we can't generalize from our statistical sample size of one. We are aware that it started very early, 4 billion years ago is our best guess on that. And also, the kind of conditions in these vents seem to drive the kind of carbon chemistry. And we see the same carbon molecules again on meteorites under all kinds of different sets of conditions. So interstellar dust, but also Migliori-type conditions, so lightning flashes in an atmosphere of methane and ammonia, but also in the kind of hydrothermal vents I'm talking about. We keep seeing the same subset of organic molecules being formed in all kinds of radically different conditions. So all of these point to life being probably quite common.
So you're saying that it's almost a natural consequence of basic chemistry.
I see it that way, for sure, yes. Where there's much more of an issue, though, is complex life. So we are all composed of a particular cell type called a eukaryotic cell. So large, complex cells with a nucleus, and the DNA, the genes, are all stored in the nucleus. And there's quite a mystery about how these complex cells arose. It appears to have happened only once on Earth in the 4 billion years. So it's not something which seems to be an inevitable outcome of natural selection acting on practically infinite populations of bacteria.
And how long did it take for those cells to emerge after
It took about 2 billion years. Again, it's hard to know, does that mean anything? Was it just that the conditions were right after 2 billion years for this to happen? For example, perhaps oxygen levels rose around that time. It seems, in fact, though, to be a biological constraint, which is to say all these complex cells have got cells living within them. We have cells living within our cells, they're the mitochondria. They're no longer independent free-living cells, but they started out as bacteria. They provide all the energy that complex cells need to live, not just to live, but to have a very large and complex genome to support the kind of genetic complexity that's required for complex life. So this seems to be the singular event. Now, perhaps it happened on multiple occasions, we just don't know. But all we know for a fact is that all complex life on Earth shares a common ancestor that already had the mitochondria, which gave it the energy required to become large and complex, but also put a huge strain on the relationship, if you like. They have to get along in very intimate circumstances. And that seems to have driven the evolution of all kinds of traits like sex and two sexes and why we age and die and all those kind of things. Bacteria don't really do any of that. Complex cells always do that, and it seems to have arisen in that context. So it may be that there's some kind of bottleneck there that makes complex, intelligent life much more difficult than the origin of life.
So what you're saying is that there could well be loads of different types of aliens out there, but they might just all be essentially germs.
Well, that would be the depressing possibility, I suppose. I'm not sure anybody would want to find that. And this is a hypothesis that may or may not be true. My own thinking suggests that it probably is true, but there's only one way to test a hypothesis, and that's to test it, to go out there and make some observations. So I'm all in favour of trying to do that.
So we've touched on a couple of factors that are involved in the Drake equation. Frank, I'd be interested in your take on this and whether overall, knowing more about exoplanets and maybe knowing more about how life emerged initially on Earth, whether you're more or less optimistic than when you set out that we'll eventually hear something.
Oh, well, I tend to be optimistic, maybe just because I hope there is life elsewhere in the universe. But we're not quite sure how life came to be. We have identified a number of pathways and chemical situations in the oceans and in the warm little ponds and such where the chemicals of life can be produced. I think one of the most telling things has already been mentioned, and that is that life appeared at the earliest time it could have on the Earth, which suggests that the process that gives rise to it was not a difficult one. And, of course, there may be more than one way. Anyway, what we know about life is that it is opportunistic and adaptable. So with regard to its chemistry, that is the basic way in which it functions, and also when it comes to evolution. And so I am optimistic not only that life is very abundant in the universe, but also that complex life, including intelligent creatures, are also very common.
I'm interested just generally in almost the career choice of deciding to spend time focusing on this question that's such a big unknown. Andrew, is that something that worries you at all, that you could spend, you know, the next couple of decades of your career focused on this search and never come out with anything?
No, it doesn't worry me at all. I think I was motivated to get into this field by the same awe and wonder that anybody feels when they go out and they look up at the sky and they see the stars and they wonder whether there might be someone out there looking back at us. And I find it to be really a privilege to get to spend my time and my career in astronomy and astrophysics trying to answer what I believe to be the most important question that we can ask.
Obviously, it must be a brilliant job to say that you do when you're at a party, that you're searching for aliens. But on a day-to-day level, does it ever get a bit more mundane and boring than that when you're searching through kind of realms of data that don't show any signal?
Well, it was starting to get a little bit boring until about 2 months ago. And then I heard about this project called Breakthrough Listen from Jeff Marcy. And then things got very, very exciting. Like any job, you know, there's a lot of sitting in front of a computer and a lot of hard work and a lot of debugging computer code. There are frustrating times, certainly. But, you know, when I go to bed at night or I walk outside to take a break, I can look up at the sky and I can know that I'm trying to answer a question that humanity has probably asked since we first started to walk on two legs. So it's an incredible privilege, and I'm very excited to do it.
Jeff, I'd be interested in what you made of that as well. I mean, all this data that's coming in, presumably most of which won't provide that signal that we're looking for, is it being used for other stuff as well? Or, you know, are there ways to keep it interesting on a day-by-day level?
This is a great question. What we're going to do with the breakthrough funding is explore a much wider range of frequencies, as Frank Drake mentioned, by a factor of almost 100, actually. We're going to survey many more stars, up to a million stars, hundreds of galaxies. And as we point the radio telescope from one target to the next, spending maybe a half an hour on each one looking for signals, we will be able to detect not just radio transmissions from intelligent life, but we may detect pulsars, quasars, flares on stars, rapid bursts of radio emission coming from magnetic fields, north and south poles colliding and destroying each other, something that indeed happens on the sun. We'll be able to detect phenomena that we haven't even imagined. By pointing our radio telescope, surveying all these frequencies, long exposure times, we may detect phenomena in our universe that we humans have never imagined.
And if you do hear something, what happens then? What do you do with the signal? And will you have to announce it, or will it be immediately obvious to anyone who's following the project?
There's a very serious challenge here. Suppose you point your telescope at a star. You've been doing it for a few years, and suddenly you see radio waves coming from that star, maybe at a particular frequency. How do you know that's actually from an advanced technological civilization, or could it just be some natural phenomenon, some kind of a laser in the radio wave domain, or some kind of nebulosity, some gases that are conspiring by their temperature and their turbulence to produce radio waves? All of those are possible, including magnetic fields and other phenomena that we haven't thought of. So how do you know it's actually intelligent life? Well, there are a few ways. I'll mention a couple. If the radio waves come at one specific frequency, very narrowly confined to a set of frequencies or one specific frequency, that's something nature by itself can't do. There's always some breadth of frequencies. In addition, if there's a frequency that's strong from a star of radio waves, we will look at it carefully to see if the frequency is modulated. Frequency modulation, FM, is how we humans send information, music and talk radio, so to speak, by radio waves, or we modify the amplitude, AM, and so on. So we'll be able to examine the radio waves to see if they're behaving in a way, narrowly confined frequencies, modulation of some sort, that nature wouldn't naturally do. That kind of study might take another whole year of work using other radio telescopes. And over the course of that year, we'll build up the rationale, the logic, that suggests that advanced technological life might be the origin of those radio waves. There'll be no way to prove it, I would say, unless we can actually decode it and see that, in fact, they're sending pictures, three-dimensional holograms, poems, who knows.
When we conduct these searches, isn't a risk that we're imagining that the thing we're looking for looks something like us? I'd be interested in what you made of that, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to be limited by our own imagination. But at the same time, we can think about, well, why is life the way it is here? What can we understand about the fact that we seem to need water, that life is carbon-based? Could it be another way? I think to a large extent, we will find that it is this way for good reasons. So carbon, for example, is particularly good at carbon chemistry, the kind of chemistry you require to produce the large complex molecules that make up cells, much better than silicon, for example. And it dissolves in water or doesn't dissolve in water, depending on exactly what is bound onto it. So you have cells are made up of a mixture of things that dissolve and don't dissolve. carbon doesn't dissolve nearly as well in methane, in liquid methane, for example. So the idea of methane lakes with complex carbon chemistry is less likely. And carbon is abundant. It's one of the most abundant elements in the universe, and it's available as a gas. So cells can take effectively single Lego bricks and attach them on to make larger molecules, whereas silicon dioxide is sand. It's at a molecular scale, it's enormous. So there's good reasons why life is carbon-based here. There's good reasons why water is such a good solvent. There's good reasons for a lot of the kind of chemistry that we see. Now, that doesn't mean it's always got to be like that, but on a probabilistic basis, if we were to find life on 1,000 different planets, chances are it would be carbon-based on 990 of them, just because that's the easiest way to do it. And I think we have to think in terms of the probability. So I think looking for what we already know to be here is the most sensible way of going about it.
And taking things a step further, I mean, are we looking for biological creatures that are sending out signals, or could it even be robots or, you know, something even more advanced than we've got here?
It's certainly been widely speculated that we humans will begin replacing parts of our bodies with metal parts, and maybe even replace our brains someday, or at least augment our brains. So indeed, we may evolve to become robots. But even if so, how would those robots communicate with their satellites and their colonies on another planet or on another spaceship? It seems possible, if not indeed likely, that they would have to resort to radio transmissions, visible light, ultraviolet light, infrared light, some form of electromagnetic radiation. So even the robots might reveal themselves when we use our radio telescopes.
So if we fast forward 10 years down the line, and we'll have spent all this extra telescope time searching for signals, if we don't find anything, is that time to call it a day? Or is there a point at which you can say with reasonable certainty that there's not another civilization out there that we'll ever be in contact with? Andrew, I'll be interested in what you make of that.
Well, so broadly speaking, I would say that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is a very long-term project. It's something that I think that humanity has wondered about for all of its existence, and it's something that, as long as we have the technological capacity to pursue, I think we will pursue it at some level, or certainly we should pursue it at some level. After 10 years, we will have conducted, through this Breakthrough Listen initiative, the most sensitive, intensive, and comprehensive search for extraterrestrial intelligence, for intelligent life on other worlds, that we have ever done, that humanity has ever performed. Yet, after 10 years, there will almost certainly be new observatories, new telescopes, new technologies, and new insights about the universe that will cause us to continue to ask questions about the possibility of intelligent life on other worlds. And I think, for my part, at least personally, as long as I have the capability to do so, I will continue to work in this field, and I hope to still be around after one decade.
But, I mean, not finding anything, will that at least tell us something about where alien life might be or the nature of that life? I mean, so far we've at least established there's probably not any advanced alien civilizations in our solar system. Are we going to be able to say that about, you know, other reaches of space after we've done this extensive search?
It's a fantastic question. I think the way that I like to think about the answer to your question is that the science is a continuous process. We're continuing to do new experiments and learn more about the universe. But indeed, after an experiment of this scale, after 10 years, if we don't detect anything, then I think that is going to reinforce a message that we already have at some level, but to an even greater degree, which is the fragility and preciousness and rarity of technological life, intelligent life on our own planet. And after a few more decades, if we still haven't detected anything, I think it, again, will continue to reinforce that message. And that, in and of itself, is a very powerful message. And I hope that that's something that comes out of this research is, if we don't detect anything, or if we do, a recognition of the uniqueness and the rarity of our own species.
When you want the whole picture, you choose The Guardian. When you want to create your own, you choose Squarespace, the all-in-one website building platform that lets you buy domains, create your own logo, and more. Whatever you want to showcase, Squarespace gives you simple yet powerful tools and elegant designs to make any idea brilliant. Create your own picture at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.